Je vais tout de suite donner la parole à Madame Isabelle Ratier, qui est professeure de langue et littérature sanscrite à l'Université Paris 3 et qui va nous parler de l'un de ses domaines de spécialité, les manuscrits cachemiriens.
First of all, I must apologize for speaking English. Initially, I had, whereas my title is in French, as you can see, initially I had planned to do this in French, and then I realized that some of our distinguished guests might find an English presentation somewhat easier to follow, although I realize that many of them do speak and understand French very well. So as a compromise, I decided to keep most of the PowerPoint presentation in French, and I hope that this mixture of languages is not going to be too confusing, but anyway, we're indologists, so we should be used to confusion of languages. So, since we are here to talk about Indian philology, for my part, I would like to focus on the interest of studying the margins of Indian manuscripts. And, well, as regards European manuscript studies, The margins of manuscripts are no longer considered a marginal field of study. I hope you'll forgive the rather cheap pun, but as you can see on the screen, I'm not the only one to find it irresistible. Several researchers have recently highlighted that in the last decades, the margins of manuscripts have come to occupy a central position in the fields of medieval studies and Renaissance studies. And many works have been published on this topic. This is, of course, by no means an exhaustive list, but some of these studies have opened up some new perspectives by showing how drawings and annotations found in the margins of manuscripts can tell us a lot about the history of textual transmission, but also about reading habits and teaching habits, for example. Now, as regards Indology, so far, Indologists seem to have shown very little interest for margins. In fact, as far as I know, there is only to date one monograph entirely devoted to the study of annotated Indian Sanskrit manuscripts. It happens to be a very interesting, but also unfortunately unpublished PhD dissertation. And so, for my part, I would like today to argue that there are some very good reasons for Indologists to pursue Formigatti's line of research, and I would like to do that by examining the particular case of Kashmiri manuscripts. So, what is it that we can find in the margins of Kashmiri manuscripts? Well, usually, of course, some folio numbers with the abbreviated title of the work. Then, corrections to the main text, as here and here, where a syllable and even a couple of words had been initially omitted in the main text. Some short glosses, which are most often interlinear, and some more substantial annotations. And what are these more substantial annotations made of? Well, sometimes they're more elaborate glosses. Sometimes they're even entire commentaries, as Judith just pointed out in her beautiful presentation. But very often, these annotations happen to be quotations from works that deal with the same topic as the main text, which is copied in the center of the manuscript pages. And such quotations nowadays can be extraordinarily useful for us because they are sometimes borrowed from works that happen to be otherwise lost. So here, I'll only give you one striking example. Utpaladeva is a famous Shaiva author who lived in Kashmir in the 10th century and composed an important philosophical treatise called the Treatise on the Recognition of the Lord, Ishwara Pratyabhijna. And in fact, this treatise is made of several layers, because Utpaladeva first wrote some karikas, some verses in which he expressed his thought in a very condensed way. But while he was writing these verses, he also composed a vritti, a short prose commentary on his own verses. And then he also wrote a vivritti, or tika, that is a detailed commentary on his own verses. And this vivritti, or tika, this detailed commentary, was certainly the philosophical heart of the treatise. It explained Utpaladeva's thought in much greater detail than the karikas and vritti. And it also discussed a number of topics that do not appear at all in the karikas and vritti. So far, we had access to this vivritti, or tika, only through one single manuscript, now preserved in Delhi. That manuscript was edited and translated by Raffaele Torella a few years ago. And Torella's work on this manuscript is absolutely remarkable. The problem is that this single manuscript is in fact terribly incomplete. It only covers 13 verses out of the 190 verses that constitute the entire treatise. So what we have, what we had so far of the vivritti, was really a tiny part of Utpaladeva's work. However, a few decades after Utpaladeva, another famous Shaiva author, Abhinavagupta, composed two commentaries on the Pratyabhijna treatise that have both come down to us. One is the Vimarshini, which is a commentary on Utpaladeva's verses. And the other one is the much longer Vivritti Vimarshini, which is a commentary on Utpaladeva's almost entirely lost Vivritti. Now, as regards the Vimarshini, Abhinavagupta's shorter commentary, among the 40 or so complete Vimarshini manuscripts that I could consult so far, about a third are heavily annotated in their margins. And these annotations, it turns out, are almost exclusively quotations from various works that belong to very different traditions. And among these quotations, there are fragments of Utpaladeva's Vivritti. Now, how do we know that some of these quotations do belong to Utpaladeva's lost work? Well, first of all, sometimes the person who wrote down these annotations took the trouble of indicating their source, as here in this margin, where a sentence from the Vivritti is quoted, and then this person added, "Iti tika karaha." This is what the author of the tika has said. However, most of the time, unfortunately, the source of the quotations is not given. So when I first stumbled upon these annotations, and when I started suspecting that they contained some fragments from Utpaladeva's Vivritti, I decided to compare these margins with the Vivritti fragment already edited by Raffaele Torella. And it turned out that many passages in the fragments edited by Raffaele Torella are also found word for word in these margins. And this is one example among many. So once it was beyond doubt that these margins contain some already known Vivritti fragments, I started looking for thus far unknown Vivritti fragments, this time by comparing these margins with Abhinavagupta's Vivritti Vimarshini, Abhinavagupta's commentary on the Vivritti. And as a result, I found a number of fragments that are now edited and translated. So here I'm just showing you briefly the edited text, just to give you a rough idea of the length of these fragments. And the words underlined and in bold are the words that are quoted by Abhinavagupta in his commentary. So here was the first fragment, the second one, sparing you the footnotes, the third one, and the fourth one. Now, I should make clear from the beginning that this is, in fact, a very limited improvement on Torella's work on the Vivritti. Why? Because if we consider the treatise in its entirety once again, you can see that the fragments that could be retrieved from these margins actually bear on very few additional verses, the ones in blue here. Besides, I still haven't finished collating all the margins of these manuscripts, but so far I couldn't find a single Vivriti fragment, either before verse 135 or after verse 159. So it is becoming more and more likely that when somebody wrote for the first time in the margins of a Vimarshini manuscript some quotations from Utpaladeva's Vivriti, this person must have used a Vivriti manuscript, or several Vivriti manuscripts, but more probably one, that must have been already very incomplete at the time. Only this manuscript must have contained a few additional folios before and after the manuscript studied by Raffaele Torella, which is why so far I could only find fragments that come either immediately before or immediately after the fragments edited by Raffaele Torella. This being said, I recently stumbled upon another, much longer Vivriti fragment, and it was found again in some margins, but this time in the margins of a Vivriti Vimarshini, so Abhinavagupta's longer commentary. Vivriti Vimarshini manuscripts are far less common than Vimarshini manuscripts, probably because of the unusual length of the Vivriti Vimarshini, and probably for the same reason, they're usually devoid of significant annotations. But I recently stumbled upon one exception to this in the form of a manuscript now preserved in Jammu. It's obviously a late Devanagari copy of an earlier Sharada manuscript, and at this point I do not know if the Sharada manuscript has survived somewhere. And at first sight, there is nothing to distinguish this particular manuscript from other known Vivriti Vimarshini manuscripts. For hundreds of pages, the margins are perfectly blank, apart from the occasional correction on the main text. But somewhere in the middle of this very bulky manuscript, something happens, because all of a sudden the margins get crowded with annotations. And this goes on for a few dozens of folios, and then the annotations stop just as abruptly as they started. And whereas in Vimarshini manuscripts, the annotations are quotations from very different works, well, here all the annotations too are quotations, but there are only two sources for these annotations, for these quotations, namely Utpaladeva's Vritti and Utpaladeva's Vivriti. So here are the first three annotated pages inside this manuscript, and here is the Vivriti passage that could be retrieved from these three pages. It's an interesting passage, first of all, because if you compare it with Abhinavagupta's commentary, you can see that it is most probably entirely free of any lacuna, contrary to the fragments that I could find in Vimarshini manuscripts so far. Besides, this passage belongs to a part of the Vivriti that was entirely unknown so far. And this is also good news, because this is what could be extracted from the three pages that you've just seen. But there are 76 more annotated pages in this manuscript awaiting an edition and translation. So, to sum up, here is what we knew of the Vivriti, what we had of the Vivriti, before studying the margins of Abhinavagupta's commentaries. Here is what the study of the margins of the Vimarshini has brought us so far. And here in yellow is what this new discovery brings us. And this new discovery certainly constitutes, by far, the lengthiest, continuous or almost continuous Vivriti fragment known to date, including the Vivriti Codex Unicus in Delhi. So as you can see, the margins of manuscripts can be immensely helpful when it comes to retrieving fragments and even entire chapters, as is the case here, of lost works. And of course, such annotations are by no means confined to the margins of Shaiva philosophical works. A number of scholars have mentioned over the years the presence of similar annotations in Kashmiri manuscripts that belong to very different traditions, both in the field of Shastra and Kavya. Only a few of them are mentioned here. And among these studies, in fact, one is of particular interest for us here. It bears on the Nyaya Manjari, which is another important philosophical work, but in the Nyaya tradition. And our friend and colleague, Yasutaka Muroya, has recently discovered in the margins of some Nyaya Manjari manuscripts some fragments of a famous work called the Granthi Bhanga, which had already been edited, but on the basis of only one single incomplete manuscript. Now, in this respect, what is worth noting is that this Granthi Bhanga, fragments of which were found in the margins of a Nyaya Manjari manuscript, this Granthi Bhanga happens to be a commentary on the Nyaya Manjari. And this is natural, of course, because what we normally find in the margins of manuscripts are quotations or glosses that are all meant as explanations of the main text. But in the case of Utpaladeva's Vivriti, it seems that we have a strange reversal of this situation, because today, apart from the very incomplete Vivriti manuscript in Delhi, all we have of Utpaladeva's most important philosophical work is to be found in the margins of Abhinavagupta's commentaries. So Utpaladeva's Vivriti seems to have become more and more marginal, whereas Abhinavagupta's commentaries were becoming more and more central. Why is that? I'm not sure. One reason might be that Abhinavagupta's commentaries might have appeared easier to understand than Utpaladeva's beautiful but terse and elliptical work. Besides, Abhinavagupta has authored important works in very different fields: the aesthetics of theater, the aesthetics of poetry, the interpretation of Shaiva scriptures, the practice and meaning of Shaiva ritual, and so on. And so for this reason, Abhinavagupta's fame might have surpassed Utpaladeva's early on, and this, of course, might have had a bearing on the choices that were made as to which work should be copied, preferably to others in that tradition. But whatever the causes for these choices, they have profoundly distorted our view of the respective roles played by Utpaladeva and Abhinavagupta in building the Pratyabhijna system. Basically, before Torella published his first studies on the Vivriti, historians of Indian philosophy had simply assumed that the most innovative works in the Pratyabhijna tradition were Abhinavagupta's. And they had simply ascribed to Abhinavagupta some ideas that they could find in Abhinavagupta's commentaries, but that they couldn't find in Utpaladeva's verses and vritti. But now that more and more vivriti fragments are coming to light, we can compare all of these works, and it is becoming ever more obvious that Abhinavagupta was a brilliant commentator, but that he was also a very faithful commentator, and that the most innovative work in this tradition was much rather Utpaladeva's Vivriti. Now, to mention very briefly an example that I presented in more detail recently at the Cornell Conference. In many of his works, Abhinavagupta explains that the various phenomena that constitute the universe as we experience it are somewhat similar to reflections, pratibimba. Why? Because when we see some reflections, some variegated reflections in a mirror, the reflections that we see are perfectly real. They're not illusions because they're really occurring right there on the surface of the mirror as we see it. Yet, says Abhinavagupta, these reflections have no existence of their own, independently of the surface of the mirror, that makes these reflections manifest simply by taking on their various forms. And in the same way, says Abhinavagupta, phenomena are perfectly real. they're not to be discarded as mere illusions, contrary to what some Advaita Vedantins contend. Yet they are nothing over and above the universal, all-encompassing and all-powerful consciousness that is Shiva, and that makes these phenomena manifest just by taking on their forms. Now, this famous Pratibimbavada, this famous doctrine of reflections, so far had been ascribed by most historians of Indian philosophy to Abhinavagupta, at least in its most refined conceptual form. The problem with this is that Utpaladeva himself, in his commentary on another Shaiva treatise, mentions in passing that he has explained at length in his Tika on the Pratyabhijna treatise how phenomena are similar to reflections. And in this respect, there's a very interesting passage right at the beginning of the first annotated page in the Vivriti Vimarshini manuscript that I just showed you, because there Utpaladeva already formulates this Pratibimbavada, this doctrine of reflections, and he does so while using a technical vocabulary that so far was rather considered to be Abhinavagupta's innovation. So here is a case where the study of margins can actually help us correct our views on the history of a philosophical system. Now, as regards the origin, the history, the purpose, or the purposes of these annotations, very little is known to date. And I hope that this topic can be further investigated in the coming years. Camillo Formigatti has suggested that since so many of these annotations happen to be quotations, and often very lengthy ones, these quotations were what he calls a mnemonic support for the teachers while they were explaining the main text to their students. Now, whether this was the case or not, what seems clear is that these annotated manuscripts were produced in learned circles by men who were often themselves authors of independent works or commentaries, and these men often copied themselves manuscripts, and including the main text, not only the annotations. This can be seen from the fact, for example, that the oldest annotated Vimarshini manuscript that is preserved in Srinagar was copied by a man called Rajanaka Shankarakanta, as is stated by the colophon. Now, this man was the father of Rajanaka Ratnakanta, and Rajanaka Ratnakanta, we know, was active in the 17th century, and he was famous not only for composing some Shaiva works of his own, but also for copying himself a great number of manuscripts, as was already noted by Stein in his Rajatarangini. And there's also a very nice autograph that was reproduced in Jörgen Hanedal's beautiful edition of the of Ratnakanta's Stotras. Now, there's more to this, because this Ratnakanta also happened to be the master of Rajanaka Bhaskarakanta, who is also a famous Shaiva author, who has authored, in fact, a commentary on Abhinavagupta's Vimarshini that has come down to us. So as you can see, these annotated manuscripts were not copied by scribes who had no clue as to the content of what they were writing. They were copied by men who taught and even sometimes wrote entire commentaries on the content of the very text that they were copying. Now, admittedly, from this point of view, Kashmir underwent a spectacular change at some point around the middle of the 19th century, when the Kingdom of Kashmir was annexed to that of Jammu, because from that point on, many manuscripts were no longer copied in the traditional Kashmiri scripts. Many manuscripts, the Sharada script, many manuscripts were then copied in a variety of Devanagari. And as already noted by Bula, these manuscripts of a new sort were no longer copied by pandits. They were copied by professional scribes who sold these manuscripts for a living. And this brought a number of important changes. First of all, as is well known, many of these professional scribes lacked familiarity with the Sharada script. And as a result, they often confused Sharada conjuncts with somewhat similar Devanagari conjunct. Besides, the pandits who copied Sharada manuscripts were in the habit of correcting the text that they were copying when they felt that something was amiss with the text as it was transmitted. Whereas these professional scribes who transcribed Sharada manuscript into Devanagari obviously didn't understand, most of them at least, the content of what they were copying. And as a result, they refrained from making corrections to the text, even in cases, as in this particular margin, where the correction would have seemed obvious to any pandit. And in fact, they even very often faithfully indicated whenever they failed to read some aksharas by using dots or dashes sometimes. And this also happens, in fact, in Sharada manuscripts. But in my experience, admittedly a very limited one, it is much more common in Devanagari manuscripts than in Sharada manuscripts. Now, this at first sight might seem to be contradictory with Bula's famous remarks that many Kashmiri Devanagari manuscripts were cooked, as he says, that is, heavily restored, the restoration that sometimes bordered on mere forgery. In fact, though, I don't think that the manuscript I just showed is an exception in this respect, neither do I think that in the end it's contradictory with Bühler's remark. Why? Because, as already noted by Michael Witzel, in fact, there are many known instances of Devanagari, of Kashmiri Devanagari manuscripts that very faithfully record any lacuna in the text. And this is the case, it seems to me, because these Devanagari manuscripts were produced in order to be sold, but they were produced in order to be sold to pandits, who could then correct the text as they wished. Anyway, these changes also affected the margins, more specifically, first of all, because since most of these professional scribes couldn't understand what they were copying, they naturally refrained from adding annotations of their own in the margins. And as a result, the practice of annotating manuscripts that had been so lively in Kashmir for centuries tended to slow down and even to freeze from that point on. Besides the pandits who copied these Sharada manuscripts very often didn't take the trouble of using a reference mark inside the main text to make clear which particular part in the main text this or that annotation was supposed to explain. So they just wrote the annotation in the margin just as close as possible to the relevant part of the main text. Now, when professional scribes transcribed such Sharada manuscripts into Devanagari, they very faithfully copied all the marginal annotations. But a number of them seem to have thought that it was a good idea to save paper by copying all the marginal annotations one after the other without leaving any kind of gap, as in this particular manuscript. And the result is, of course, very strange because on this particular page, what is said in the marginal annotations, in fact, has nothing to do with what is said in the main text, because these annotations are meant to explain something that is going to be said one chapter ahead. So, of course, this must have made this particular manuscript particularly difficult to read and to study, but this does not mean that we should dismiss these late Devanagaris out of hand, if only because the Sharada manuscripts out of which they were made have often disappeared. And for example, the longest known Vivriti manuscript was found in one of these Devanagari manuscripts. So, to conclude briefly, I realize that studying tiny little scribblings in the margins of manuscripts might look like a particularly useless hobby or even a strange philological perversion. I do believe, however, that we have a lot to learn from these margins because they contain fragments of lost texts, many of which are still waiting to be discovered. And the fragments, the study of these fragments, can enable us to correct our views on works that came to be marginalized in the course of time, but that were actually very innovative and influential in their time. And of course, there's a lot that we don't know. There's a lot that I don't know about these marginal annotations, but it seems to me that they can still tell us much about, well, for example, the works that were available to these pundits who were annotated manuscripts, and also about their reading habits and their writing habits and their teaching habits, and about the changes that all these habits must have undergone. So I hope that in the coming years, the margins of Indian manuscripts, and not just Kashmiri manuscripts, can finally attract all the scholarly attention that they deserve. Thank you very much.